I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We're coming up to the third anniversary of the landslides in Johnston's Landing. On the 12th of July 2012, a rapid debris avalanche descended down the mountain on the eastern shore of British Columbia's Kootenay Lake. Four people were killed, as well a number of houses were destroyed. Amanda Bath's home was amongst the homes devastated, and the next day she went back to look for her cat. She just missed being hit by a second landslide, which buried her house. You might recall the video that went viral, shot by Global News. That was Bath managing to escape just in time. She has written a book about the experience, as well as the community and the members of which were killed. The book is called Disaster in Paradise, The Landslides at Johnston's Landing. It chronicles the devastation and the recovery, as well as remembers the dead. It looks at this BC community and those that rallied around it, as well as what's happened in the 3 years since. Amanda Bath was born and raised in England and moved to Johnston's Landing in 1993. She holds a PhD in Catalan Literature and lives in Caslow, BC, now with her husband, Christopher Klassen. This is her first book, and it's from Harbor Publishing. It's a wonderfully written account that you ought to get. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Caslow, BC, Amanda Bath. Dr. Bath, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Your publisher, Howard White, was on the program a couple of weeks ago, and he made mention of your book, and I happen to have had it on my desk, and so I thought we ought to talk about it, especially since we're coming up to 3 years. This is something that you live with, something that you've experienced, but for those of us, wherever we are in British Columbia, this is something we ought to remember, isn't it?
Indeed, it is. I think, well, in concrete terms, anyone who lives in a small community on the side of a mountain, which so many people in this part of the world do, you need to be aware of things that can happen. I always thought that natural disasters happened elsewhere, probably in other countries, and definitely to other people. And to find one happening to me was an extraordinary thing. And to be on the receiving end of assistance from the Red Cross and all the things that happened, it was surreal. But these natural disasters, particularly extreme weather-related, are going to happen more frequently, I'm sorry to have to say.
And we'll talk about the causes of that in just a sec, but in terms of, because for a lot of us, especially someone like me who's lived in British Columbia my whole life but really haven't traveled the province very much, for a lot of us, we hadn't heard of Johnston's Landing until about 3 years ago. Could you sort of situate it on a map? I mean, I was looking at a map earlier, and it looks closer to Calgary than it does Vancouver. Is that right?
Well, I would say it's about halfway, equidistant. It's due north of Spokane, Washington. That's one of the landmarks that's easy to find. We're in the trench between the Selkirk and the Purcell Mountains, and these are, I would laughingly call them the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. I mean, they're still pretty impressive mountains. But then to the east of us are the Rockies proper on the other side of the Purcells. So it's a long trench-like fjord-like lake, an absolutely beautiful place. Kootenay Lake's about 100 miles long and a couple of miles wide in its widest places. And there are communities all around it, very much on the edges of the mountain.
And how long have people lived there?
Well, I think the first white person habitation began in the 1800s. Of course, the Aboriginal, the First Nation people, the Kootenai tribe, and other native peoples have been living there for probably 10,000 years.
Yeah, and 3 years ago, how many people lived there?
In Johnston's Landing, we were a community of about 35 full-time residents, who, including my husband and myself, and that number might double in the summer. So very tiny. We're one of the most remote communities in the West Kootenay. The road literally stopped and still stops at Johnston's Landing.
Yeah. There's a map at the front of the book, and that shows us what Johnston's Landing, sort of how it was set up, and the sort. And I see about 25, 30 houses there, so that makes up the 35 full-time residents. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Well, there might be a few more in some houses, and then some of those buildings might be empty until, except in the summer when people would come and live there. So it varied a little bit. It's just a really a map that shows it shows how the landslide divided the community in half. It came right down the center, and so to the north and to the south there are houses that are perfectly safe. They're beyond the zone of hazard that has been identified. And so people, of course, continue to live there.
And how would you get to, say, someone's house? I mean, it, just in terms of size, is this something that you'd have to drive to, say, or can you walk, say, from the...
To visit somebody?
Yeah, from where...
Well, you mean from...
Say, from where you lived up to the Kootenai Joe Farm, say.
Okay, I would walk. I mean, you know, we didn't tend to use the car except when we went out around the lake to go to Caslow, the nearest village, or Nelson, the nearest town. So there's a lot of walking and a lot of uphill. It's a very healthy place to live because you get plenty of exercise.
Yeah, and you tell the story in the book about how you and Christopher ended up there, and that was in the early 90s. Is that right?
Yes, it was a pretty amazing thing because I'm a city girl born and raised. I've lived in London, England most of my life, apart from 4 years in Barcelona. And so and when Christopher and I met and fell in love, and he asked if I could envisage living in Canada, I immediately assumed we would be going to somewhere like Vancouver or you know, Toronto. And instead, we came to Johnson's Landing, where his sister was living. And I fell in love with it instantly. I remember crossing the ferry from Kootenai Landing to Balfour, which is a little south of Caslow. You have to cross. If you come up the east side of the lake, you need to cross on the free ferry that takes you. Beautiful thing. And as soon as I saw Kootenai Lake, I got this feeling in my heart that I had found my place. And sure enough, we lived there for the next 20 years very, very happily until the landslide.
Yeah, so I'm curious to know what the allure is for people. I mean, obviously it's bucolic, but the sort of people that make up the community, I mean, do you get a sense of what draws people there other than, say, the gorgeousness of it?
Well, you have to be a certain kind of person to enjoy that kind of remote wilderness. You need to be a person who's very content with their own company and doesn't, you know, look for the distractions of shops or certainly not, you know, movie theaters or any kind of sort of outside entertainment. Although Johnson's Landing has a community hall and there would be events and square dances and things happening. The kind of people who live there, some are retired, some are working. There is a working farm there, as you mentioned, Kootenai Joe Farm. But really very little employment. So it's tough for young people. And if you're raising a family, it's tough because the nearest schools are quite a distance. And so it tended to be that young families, when the kids reached a certain age and they needed to go to high school in Caslow, the family would rent or find a house in the village because it was just too much commuting to get the kids to the bus every day, and they'd have an hour's journey each way. So that sort of dictates the demographic. It tended to be older people who were perhaps retired who would live there.
So the 12th of July 2013, that was a Thursday, is that right?
2012,
pardon me.
Thursday.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so you and Christopher were where?
Well, it was incredibly fortunate that Christopher was well away. I mean, he was at a considerable distance. He'd gone to visit his mother down in Oregon, and that probably saved his life, because if he'd been in the vicinity, even if he had missed the first, even if he'd been out of the house and safe from the first landslide, his instinct, and he knows this, he would have wanted to get inside and try to salvage things, because the first slide didn't bury the house, it simply knocked it down. It hit the side of the house, twisted it, and the roof came down onto the ground. And you could see things, and there were ways to kind of crawl in, and he would have done that. And he would have been killed, because the second slide came down the following morning at 10 o'clock, and that buried the house deeply. So that's where he was. I, just also by incredible good fortune, had arranged to go to the village, to Caslow, with a friend, Gillian, And it may have saved her life also, because their house was very badly damaged. And so we left at 9 o'clock in the morning, and at 10:30, our houses were destroyed.
And there was no indication? I mean, I guess there's nothing that really warns you of these things, is there?
Well, there were warning signs, but we didn't know how to read them. And it's one of the things I hope this book does, is to give people information about the warning signals that you must pay attention to. The creek was running incredibly high, and that's because of all the rain in June. But then, abruptly, it changed color. It ceased to run clear. It first of all ran the color of tea. I call it a well-brewed tea color.
Uh-huh.
That was on the Tuesday. And then 24 hours after that, on the Wednesday, it got thicker, it got blacker, and then it became a slurry. It looked like chocolate mousse. It didn't even look like water anymore. And there was a horrendous smell coming down the creek of a deep sort of like a swamp, anaerobic. Also an element of sort of pine, like I called it mashed pine trees. And, of course, things were already moving up there.
Mm.
And we were watching this. The higher up the creek, a resident was watching that it would surge. It would come in a big wave, and then it would die back, and it would scour out the creek, and then it would fill it with silt. Now, these apparently are classic signs that a landslide is about to happen, but we didn't realize.
And say someone listening to us sees some of these warning signs. At that point, is the instinct to get away? Is that what you'd suggest, say, if knowing now what you know?
Oh, yes, get well away. Yes, and in fact, the opposite was happening. The day before the landslide, the peculiar activity in the creek had broken one of the water lines that fed water to the south side of Johnson's Landing. And there was a whole crew of people working in the creek trying to reconnect the water line. Must have been 6, 7, maybe 8 people, and other people coming and watching and all amazed by the look of the creek. Well, you shouldn't be doing anything like that when it's turned that color and is behaving in that way.
Yeah, and nothing had happened like this before, had it?
No. We'd had avalanches. In fact, there had been an avalanche that winter of 2011-2012. It happened in February 2012. There was a significant avalanche that came down the creek right to the place where the creek does a turn. It turns to the left and then goes down again, and that would be very significant when the landslide came. But that was really the only thing we'd ever had to deal with, was avalanches in the winter.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so this video that everyone's seen by now, this was the next day, was it?
Yes, this was the following morning, almost exactly 24 hours after the first slide. And I was in Kaslow. I learned that our house was destroyed, and I just got this incredible need to do something practical. And of course, I was terribly worried. I mean, we don't have kids, but our cat was very meaningful to us. Perhaps I loved him too much, because when you don't have children, you do lavish a great deal of affection on an animal. And I wondered whether by any chance Ozzy was okay. And when I saw photos that people had taken that first afternoon after the first slide, that showed that the house was still visible. It had collapsed, but the windows had busted out, and there was furniture visible. I thought if the cat was alive, he could have crawled out through the window. So I was just determined to go back and see whether by any chance he was there. And I arranged for a friend and a boat to go back the following morning. And people warned me. They warned me not to go. I don't recall anybody saying anything, because I was in a state of trauma with an absolutely clear plan for something practical that I could do, and I was bound and determined to do it, no matter how dangerous. And that's often the way. People in trauma can do very dangerous things, because you're not in your right mind.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and in those moments, when you're getting close to being buried by the second landslide, what does that add to the trauma? I mean, did you process that right away?
Oh, well, no. It was the most terrifying thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And really, it was all over in very few seconds. We landed on the shore Everything looked identical to the pictures I'd seen that uh-huh. people had taken the previous day. I could see our weirdly deformed house, all just sandwiched the roof down on the deck. I got to call Ozzy, I think, once. I took one photograph, and then we heard this snapping noise, which were trees just snapping like matchsticks by the power of what was beginning to move down. And then there was a roaring sound, and the boat operator was screaming at us to get back into the boat. This is my friend Osa and me, and we just got in. This all happened within about 30 seconds of arrival, really. The timing was astounding.
Yeah.
And we just got off the shore. We were followed out by this wave of debris. It was like a sort of small tsunami as the mud hit the lake, and it was flushing down all those trees and everything that had been caught in the creek ravine and had been held there for 24 hours. And, of course, the creek had been trying to run all that time, and it had been saturating the landslide debris more and more until it became liquid mud and had to move again. And that was what came down at precisely that moment when we were there.
Do you have a sense, Amanda, of how those that were killed, what they might have been going through?
Well, I try to imagine it, and I have something of an idea because I interviewed all the other eyewitnesses, everybody else who was actually there, some who saw it, many who heard it. So I have a sense, and it was very fast. The people who died lived on the bench of land. It's sort of like halfway down the creek from the source, between the source and the lake. There's a place where, as I mentioned, the creek does a turn, and that's where the avalanche had stopped in the winter. Well, this massive amount of debris, I don't know, numbers don't really make any sense. It was 320,000 cubic meters. Well, that's meaningless.
Yeah.
But somebody said, well, that's 32,000 dump trucks of material, and that perhaps gives a little bit more idea. But when it hit that bend in the creek, half of the debris couldn't make the turn, and it leapt out and rushed across the bench of land, which is, of course, inhabited. The first house that was destroyed and the lady in it was killed, her house took the full force of this massive landslide, and the house, from what we can tell, exploded. Her body was never found, and I really don't imagine it could have been. But there was so much debris, it rolled a great distance, and this is at great speed. This is in the space of about 20, 25 seconds.
Yeah.
It was going at 150 kilometers an hour, they reckon. And then the house where the three other victims died was a long way from the creek. No one would have ever imagined that house could be at risk.
Uh-huh.
And it flattened the house. And their bodies were found behind the house. They had time, obviously, to come outdoors. Perhaps they thought they were going to take refuge behind the house, but it was impossible. The noise would have been something that engenders huge panic because it was like, somebody who heard it said it was like a 747 jet low-flying, and as I say, it was coming incredibly fast.
And would you give us the names of the four who died? Because I think it's good to remember them. And did you know them well?
Well, we knew them, yes. Some better than others. Petra Frazee was the lady who lived in the house closest to the creek. She was German and spent half of the year in Johnson's Landing. She loved the landing. It was her sole home. She just lived for the 6 months of the year that she could spend in her little cabin there. She was 64. And then in the other house, there was Valentine Weber and his two daughters, Diana, aged 22, and Rachel, aged 17, who should not have been there. I mean, Christopher and I were so fortunate that we were out of our house. Those two girls had come up the evening before. Diana lived in Los Angeles. Rachel had a summer job in the village around the lake in Caslow. The evening before the landslide, they drove up together to spend some time with their dad, and they were having breakfast with him when the landslide killed them all.
Yeah.
It's a tragic story.
It is, yeah. And from what I read of the book, yeah, you know, you do talk in the book about fate, about premonitions and coincidences. What have you taken away from all of this, as well as having written a book about it now, in terms of what happens in life and with regards to, say, chance and the sort? I mean, yeah, this is something you probably have thought about, haven't you?
Well, of course, you do. You do. I was in a state of, I don't know, real upset and disquiet about the whole thing. The fact that these two young girls would die, and I, age 57, who'd had, you know, a very good life already, that I would be spared. And, of course, you know, it is coincidence. It is just the chance of fate, who lives and who dies. But you do think about these things, and there's no explanation for it. But there were several things that happened that can't be explained, and they are in the book. Extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was a young woman who was a very close friend of Diana, who died, and she had a premonition. She had a dream, in fact, 6 weeks beforehand, where she saw Diana's dad's house, Val's house, buried in mud. And she told Diana, she said, "I had a terrible dream that your house was buried in mud and you all died." And they kind of laughed about it. She's actually my niece, Margie. And so she told Diana, she told another friend, and then Diana told another friend that Margie had had this dream. So there's good evidence this did indeed happen. And then it transpired exactly the way Margie had seen it in her dream. And there's no explanation for these things.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to make of it, except to say that there's more that goes on in the universe than we have explanations for.
Exactly.
And in a way, that's a very wonderful thing, that there are mysteries that cannot be explained scientifically. And I think about these things quite a lot now.
Yeah. And so how do you deal with grief and trauma? Because, I mean, this is obviously something that few have gone through, and this is something that you'll obviously never forget.
Yes.
Was it a long road to stay today?
It certainly was a long road. Writing the book was part of my therapy. I really couldn't help myself. This book seemed to channel through me. It was a book that wanted to be written, and I was in a position to do it, and it helped me initially very much. I think people in trauma often do need to tell their story or write their story down, and it's a way of coming to terms with it. So that was one thing that was incredibly helpful. Another was to get counseling, and I was fortunate in Caslow that there was a wonderful counselor who worked through the local community services society, and she was a specialist in grief and trauma counseling, and I was able to see her for about 2 months through August and September 2012, and she helped me very, very much indeed. But it is a journey, and it's a journey I tell in the book. And it's interesting, it didn't occur to me that this book would be helpful to people who have suffered other kinds of grief, but a number of readers have come to me and said, you know, your book, I'm recommending it to my grief support group, that it has helped me so much to deal with my own journey through grief. Because I try to tell what it feels like, how you are sort of mad at the beginning, you're even euphoric, there's lots of surges of adrenaline, then you go into deep depressions, you get angry, you scream at people, and then you cry a lot. And there's also the added element that when you've suffered a sudden trauma triggered by something like a landslide, mm-hmm. if you hear any sound that's similar, it brings it all back, and you go back into panic mode. So if I heard any snapping noise or thunderclaps or a sudden roaring, I would be absolutely incapacitated. I mean, I did have an experience where I was actually crossing the slide on the rebuilt road, and there were some pebbles that clattered in the culvert that went under the road, and I thought it was another landslide coming down, and I gunned my foot to the floor, and the car leapt, you know, up the hill, And then I couldn't breathe. My limbs turned to jelly, and I was almost physically sick because in that second, it didn't take more than a split second to be right back there on the shoreline thinking I was about to die. Mm. And that, with time, has ceased to be a big issue. If you deal with the trauma, it doesn't have to turn into post-traumatic stress disorder, which is the illness that people, you know, do suffer from if they don't adequately treat the trauma at the beginning. But I think I did get good treatment.
Hmm. And the other thing that from what I've read of the book thus far, that one gets out of it, is the fact that there are people who are good, but beyond that, that people are resilient, aren't they?
They are. And I found this over and over. When I was interviewing the 35 people for the book, which included, you know, many of the inhabitants of Johnson's Landing, some of whom have had to move. There's a couple, they were in their 70s, retired. They really never imagined they were going to have to start all over again with a different house. And yet I was so filled with admiration by people's stoicism and how they just get on and they take the next step after the other, and you find a way to go forward. Human resilience is an amazing thing. You think you'll never get over something as massive, something as tragic as this, but somehow you do. You're never the person that you were before. That isn't going to be. But you find ways to go forward as a new person. Mm-hmm. I used an image in the book. It's rather like a war veteran who's an amputee. Well, you're never going to get your limb back, but you're going to find a way to function around that loss and move forward. It's a little bit like that.
So where your house once stood, what's there now?
Nothing. There is landslide debris. We excavated. I mean, that's another whole part of the story. Christopher's way of dealing with his grief was to hire a friend of ours, an excavator operator, and to spend the month of August digging. So in that month after the slide, the place looked like a garbage pit. And there are pictures in the book, color photos that show Christopher in the pit. A very dangerous place, right beside the creek, in the path of the landslide. I didn't like him being there. The people were saying there was a risk of another slide, but he was determined to see what we could salvage. So that was in August, and then that pit was filled in, and now it's a rough terrain. We have a little boulder, quite a large boulder that marks what was the center of the house. And the view down the lake is fabulous because all the trees are gone. So it's not pretty. In time, it will green up, and there's been some replanting of trees to try to green up the slide as quickly as possible. But it isn't a pretty place to my eye.
Yeah. And would you speak to the response that you got from, say, police, from provincial government officials, federal government officials, if they were involved, as well as, say, insurance companies? I mean, this is something that you all had to go through.
Yes. Well, in our case, the thing is, we didn't actually own that house. We had been the caretakers of it for 17 years. So, of course, we treated it like it was our own home, and certainly we had complete carte blanche to do what we wanted. Christopher had landscaped it. We were re-roofing the house at the time it was destroyed. But, you know, we didn't have house insurance. It didn't belong to us. But house insurance did not pay out because acts of God, as they call them, of this kind, land, movement of the earth, avalanche, earthquake, flood and landslide are not covered by house insurance. So our neighbors up the hill, who indeed did have house insurance, didn't receive a penny from their insurance company. But the provincial government has a program of disaster financial assistance, and it's not designed to put you back where you were before. It's designed to be a hand up to help you to go forward. So they will not give you back the value of what you lost, but they'll calculate. It'll only kick in if it's your primary residence. So several people, didn't get payments because it wasn't their primary residence. But if it was your primary residence, the government would pay you 80% of the assessed value. they wouldn't cover the land and the outbuildings. Of course, for people in rural areas, so much value lies in the larger property and the outbuildings and the tools, and that would not necessarily be covered by this program. But there was a payment, and we were assisted. Christopher had lost all his carpentry tools, and he is a professional carpenter, so we got some help with that. And then in the immediate aftermath of the landslide, we were helped by the Emergency Social Services, which is another program of Emergency Management BC, and we were given vouchers which would give us some clothes, some groceries, some a tank of gas for the car, just immediate needs, because we literally had the clothes we stood up in, and everything else in the house was gone. And it's an extraordinary feeling to sort of, I realized that little by little, okay, I've lost my passports, I've lost my credit cards, we've lost so many documents and things like that, that you need in everyday life. The Red Cross was the other agency that was fantastic, and they provided Christopher with new work boots, and they paid for us to both have eyeglasses replaced, opticians, things like that. Very helpful. You know, in other countries, they could only dream of having assistance like that. And people are always, I think, ready to complain and say, well, I wish it was more, I wish it was better. But really, it was a tremendous help when it came. And it was a weird and extraordinary thing to be on the receiving end of so much largesse. Of course, the community was the other great assistance to us. People just flocked to help us in any and every way they could. All around Kootenay Lake, the village of Caslow had all these sort of refugees from Johnson's Landing who were wandering around like zombies, and people were coming up and giving us hugs and paying for us to have meals in restaurants. And the thrift store just said, take anything you need to wear. And all of that was a great comfort and a great help.
Yeah, and you've documented all of this in the book, and it's a wonderful service that you've done, because it tells the story that we need to remember. And as you've alluded to already, there's a lot in this book that I suspect will help a lot of people.
I hope so. Yeah. That would be a wonderful thing if the book could be assistance to others.
Yeah, Amanda, this is a beautifully written book. It's a very fine achievement. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it and everything else.
Thank you so much, Joseph. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
The same. The book is called Disaster in Paradise, The Landslides in Johnson's Landing. It's from Harbor Publishing. Do pick it up. It's a great read. It's a harrowing story, obviously, but it's wonderfully written that I think you'll get something out of it. If not, you'll enjoy it. Its author, Amanda Bath, joined me on the line from Caslow, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.